Today is Wednesday, August 15th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, a rising death toll following a highway bridge collapse in Italy that sent cars plummeting.
It's a massive wreckage there on top of cars and trucks that went over that bridge and were on that bridge when it collapsed.
A car plows into a group of people near Britain's parliament.
Then they started pointing their guns into the vehicle, circling the car, and then they appeared to drag somebody out of the car.
Also ahead, scientists are sounding an alarm over plans to drill for oil in the nation's largest wildlife refuge. It's all on today's International Edition. Italy's prime minister says at least 26 people have been killed and several others injured in highway bridge collapse in Genoa. Giuseppe Conte traveled to the site of the disaster late Tuesday, calling it an immense tragedy. He warned the death will climb as rescuers search for victims. Conte also praised the hundreds of rescue workers still at the site, saying they saved people who fell 45 meters and are now alive and in the hospital. Reporter Josephine McKenna joins us with the latest on the recovery efforts. She is in Italy. Where do things stand right now with the tragedy?
Well, more than 300 firefighters and other emergency workers are working through the night, desperately trying to find survivors who are buried beneath tons of concrete and steel and bitumen that have fallen with the bridge as it collapsed. Now, they're using hydraulic cranes and sniffer dogs trying to find anyone who might still be alive beneath the rubble. So it's very dramatic. They're using the sorts of techniques that they normally use in an earthquake situation, because Italy, as we know, is an earthquake-prone country. And it's a very grim task. They're just trying to listen for any sounds of anyone crying for help. But this is quite different to an earthquake in the sense that this collapse is really tons of debris. It's not just a few buildings. It's a massive wreckage there on top of cars and trucks that went over that bridge and were on that bridge when it collapsed.
Are they aware of people that have been reported missing, or are they just being very cautious to make sure anyone that may still be alive would be rescued?
Well, the civil protection authorities said that there were 30 vehicles on that stretch of the bridge when it collapsed just before midday, and three of those vehicles were trucks. So from that, they're not quite sure precisely the number of missing, but they certainly feel that there are still some people that are not accounted for, at least a dozen not accounted for. And having said that, we've also heard some amazing stories of survival. Two different men who were in separate vehicles went over the top as the bridge collapsed in their cars, and one of them fell around 80 yards down. His vehicle was sitting on top of the debris and he managed to walk away with no injury whatsoever. And another man also went over in his truck and walked away with a minor injury to his shoulder and his hip. Having said that, there are around 15 injured and some of them very seriously who've been taken to hospitals in that area.
It's really miraculous that anybody could survive something like that just in and of itself.
Oh, it's incredible. And you can probably see and hear the voices of the horrified witnesses as they were shouting and screaming into their cell phones as they watched the bridge collapse. And one man was interviewed saying that he and his family were in their car just behind the section that collapsed. He grabbed his children and just ran, and people were running and screaming and just trying to get off that bridge, as you can imagine, as quickly as possible. Now, the firefighters have also evacuated around 440 people from 11 apartment buildings next to that bridge. They're afraid that there may be more collapses, and they're not willing to take that risk. So people are really shaken and anxious and in shock in that city of Genoa tonight.
Are officials saying that something like this was unexpected, or were there issues with this bridge before this?
Well, first of all, we've had some eyewitnesses say to the media that they saw a thunderbolt strike the bridge during the storm, which may or may not have provoked the bridge's collapse. Now, that hasn't been confirmed by investigators. Apart from that, there has been an ongoing debate about the safety of this bridge for several years, and a former senator even challenged the former transport minister to do something about it. He made complaints to Parliament saying that this bridge was unsafe and there needed to be intervention. And the authority that is responsible for this bridge was conducting some works on the bridge and had recently put out to tender a contract for some sort of reconstruction or renovation of the bridge. But many people in that area feel that it was too much too late and there was too much discussion going on when the security and the safety of this bridge was at stake. And now people are very angry and upset.
Are officials still talking about possibly more fatalities before this is all finished?
There is concern that there will be more fatalities. People are cautious about saying anything right now, but it certainly looks grim when you look at how the vehicles, the cars, the trucks that are being pulled out of that wreckage have been so badly crushed. It's hard to imagine anyone who's beneath the debris actually surviving this, because this was tons of concrete, steel and bitumen that fell and collapsed from that bridge and fell, you know, more than 300 feet. So it was a huge crash when it landed.
All right. That's Italy-based reporter Josephine McKenna. Thank you so much for the update. Well, police in London have arrested a man on suspicion of terrorism after he plowed his car into a group of pedestrians and cyclists before hitting a set of barriers outside Britain's Parliament building early Tuesday morning, causing three injuries. Witnesses describe what they saw.
The volume of the crash was so loud that it sounded like he must have been doing some speed, and on a roundabout you generally go slower, so it seemed to be like it was probably intentional.
Well, VOA's Steve Miller gets more from London-based reporter Amy Gutman.
This was the start of a commuter hour, though it's mid-August, so it's important to bear in mind that typically busy areas are much quieter than normal. Mm-hmm. Having said that, there were still plenty of people around. Also, it's important to note that Parliament is on summer break until September, so there wasn't the usual busyness that you would find around the Houses of Parliament there either. However, this is a very busy area for tourists, obviously, because of the Houses of Parliament, because of Westminster Abbey and Big Ben, which are all anchored right there at Westminster.
Now, there were some reports of at least two individuals being injured by the attack. What do we know about those victims?
We know very little. We know that two were taken to the hospital. One has already been released, and the other is currently still being treated for non-life-threatening injuries.
And as far as authorities, they have said that they are treating this as a terrorist incident, and one person has been arrested. What do we know about the alleged perpetrator?
We know very little about the alleged perpetrator, and that's largely because he's been refusing to cooperate with police since he's been apprehended. However, they have been able to identify him. In fact, he's known to local police in his area. They believe he's from the Midlands. That's an area 2 or 3 hours north of London. They know he's a man in his 20s, but they don't know very much more. So they don't know whether the car was borrowed, stolen, or belonged to him. They know that there were several previous owners, so it's obviously a used car. But again, whether the car was registered to him is not yet known. They will know his name, of course. They haven't released that yet. He was not on the radar of security services for the UK, but again, he was known to local police.
Now, police initially cordoned off some of the area around where the attack took place. Some of those cordons have been lifted, but how else is the government responding?
The government is responding as it usually does with these kinds of attacks, and that is with what's called a COBRA meeting. So COBRA is essentially an emergency response committee made up of ministers, police, intelligence officers, civil servants, and also very high-ranking lawyers and advisors to the Prime Minister. They'll all be meeting at Whitehall, which is a government building, to figure out whether they need to raise the threat levels, whether they can expect further attacks, you know, all of these kinds of inner workings of the government once an attack has happened, how to respond, and again, just how secure they need to make the nation. That meeting is currently still ongoing. Police have also told people to avoid the Westminster area. They had previously closed the tube station and several side streets, but cordons are now being lifted. Of course, that hasn't stopped tourists from continuing to snap selfies of themselves, even in front of these barriers.
All right, the VOA's Steve Miller talking to London-based reporter Amy Gutman. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. The U.S. defense chief is wooing Brazil as Chinese influence grows. Trump calls an ex-aide a dog who deserved to be fired. The White House expresses frustration with continued detention of U.S. pastor in Turkey. And Malta lets a rescue ship dock after EU states agree to take in migrants. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. North Korea has repeated a call for a declaration formally ending the Korean War as a way to foster mutual trust, a requirement it says is necessary for progress on denuclearization. A North Korean publication says the U.S. should take practical measures to implement what was agreed to on June 12th in Singapore between North Korean leader Kim Jong-un and President Trump. It also warned South Korea that continued sanctions and efforts to improve relations are incompatible. The article was published after the two Koreas agreed that their leaders should meet again, the third summit this year, this time in Pyongyang in September. The demands in the North Korean article are no surprise to analyst Harry Kazianis, director of defense studies at the Center for National Interest. He tells VOA's Victor Beatty the planned Korean summit comes at a time when the pace toward denuclearization is stalled.
Seems like the North Koreans want a lot of concession up front before they're willing to really even talk about denuclearization, whereas the Trump administration, their starting point in negotiations was what everybody was calling a few months ago CVID. In other words, the complete, verifiable, irreversible denuclearization of North Korea. So it's very clear that Washington and Pyongyang are basically on two very opposite ends of the spectrum. And I think what South Korea is trying to do here is trying to bridge the gap. I don't know if that's going to happen, but we're going to find out pretty soon.
Who wants this meeting more, North or South Korea, or is it mutual?
I think it's mutual. I think for Moon in South Korea, you know, his popularity has dipped a little bit. The economy is starting to have a little bit of problems. For Kim Jong-un, I think it's pretty obvious that he really wants to get South Korean investment. He's looking to try and build his legacy, and he's also trying to legitimize himself in the international arena. So for both Korean leaders, I think it's obvious the reasons why they would want to meet again.
The two at their April meeting, their first summit, agreed to push for a declaration of an end to the Korean conflict, but Ambassador Harry Harris said that would be premature at this point.
You know, I don't understand the rub why so many people are against some sort of formal declaration in the Korean War. The war is over. So it's the equivalent of everybody arguing if the sky is blue. Everybody knows the sky is blue, and it's just people view it as some sort of concession on America or Seoul's part, saying that the war is over. I think that's a good thing. I think it wouldn't be a bad idea if President Moon, Donald Trump, or Kim Jong-un maybe even met, you know, at this potential third Korean summit and ended the war. I think that would be a good way to test North Korea's intentions, because quite frankly, for many years, that has been something they have been asking for. I don't think there's any harm in doing that. And I think at that point, you could honestly go to Kim Jong-un and say, look, we've given you three meetings with Mike Pompeo. We've given you a summit with Donald Trump. Now we're ending the Korean War. Where's your turn in terms of doing what you said you would do and work towards denuclearization? If at that point they still won't talk about denuclearization, I think not only you have the international community on your side to contain North Korea, you have really the entire world on Donald Trump's side. So I think this is something that we can do.
Are you surprised at the lack of forward motion on denuclearization?
No, I'm not surprised. I mean, the North Koreans have been very clear in a lot of their public statements that denuclearization is almost an aspirational goal for them. The things they want up front before they were denuclearized that they've said in sometimes in very full-throated ways, in some ways sort of vaguely, is that they want the Korean War to be ended. They want to see some of the sanctions removed. You know, they're looking to be legitimized in the international arena as a legitimate nation.
All right. Well, meanwhile, the South Korean news agency Yonhap reports that a South Korean advance team is heading to North Korea this week to inspect preparations for the next planned family reunions involving 100 people from each side who've been separated since the armistice was signed in 1953. Well, closing arguments are scheduled to begin Wednesday morning in the trial of former Trump campaign chair Paul Manafort. U.S. District Judge T.S. Ellis III made the announcement after Manafort's attorneys rested their case without calling witnesses or presenting evidence. Asked by Ellis whether he wished to testify in his defense, Manafort responded, "No, sir." Joining us now to talk more about what happens next is Robert Deitz, professor at George Mason University and former special counsel of the National Security Agency. So did the prosecution make its case against Manafort?
Yes, absolutely.
Defense attorneys did claim on Tuesday that prosecutors have not put up enough evidence.
Well, naturally. You know, if you're a defense counsel, what are you going to argue? Because remember, the defense counsel did not call Manafort or any other witness. But I was surprised in a way that there was no witness whatsoever. The defense, so far as one can tell, is relying exclusively on harming the star witness for the prosecution, Mr. Gates. And they did really trash him on cross-examination. They showed that he embezzled money from Mr. Manafort, that he's a liar, that he was conducting affairs, and so forth. And that's all fair enough, but a jury always wants to hear the defendant testify, and the absence of it always disquieting for juries. Almost all of the government's case has been proven through documents, and documents are really, really hard to discredit. You know, you can discredit a document by saying it's a forgery, but there's no such claim here. Fact is that various bankers testified that the information they were provided was inaccurate. So I think the government has shown overwhelmingly that it's met its burden of proof.
Prosecutors, though, have been clearly concerned about the judge interjecting himself and seeming to show bias toward the defendant, Manafort. How could that possibly impact things?
That is a concern. Judge Ellis has a bit of this reputation. It is not helpful, and he's actually had to walk back. Prosecutors were looking for a jury instruction that would say to the jury, by the way, jury, I interjected a number of comments that looked like I was showing some bias. Ignore all that. So, yeah, that is a concern.
Ultimately, what do you think that the jury will come back with?
I think they're going to come back with guilty.
Is Manafort banking on a pardon from the president?
I've wondered that from the beginning. I wondered, for example, since the star witness, Gates, pled guilty and was turned state's evidence, whether anything like that went to Mr. Manafort. And, of course, I don't know the answer to it, but I can speculate. On the one hand, it's possible that Manafort doesn't really have anything of value to prosecution, so they didn't make an offer, or possibly that he wanted too much. He's facing a couple of hundred years in prison if he's convicted of these counts, or possibly that he is counting on a pardon from Mr. Trump. He might well be sympathetic and want to pardon Mr. Manafort, but that runs a huge risk for Mr. Trump politically.
Robert Deitz, professor at George Mason University and former special counsel for the National Security Agency, thanks for being with us. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Come celebrate the 60th birthday of legendary queen of pop, Madonna, on Thursday, August 16th, with a very special edition of Border Crossings. Join Larry London as he takes you back through time with a full hour of Madonna's greatest hits. With a career spanning over 35 years, Madonna has given us plenty of songs to choose from. Don't miss Border Crossings on Thursday, August 16th at 1500 Universal, as we pay tribute to one of the greatest pop stars of all time.
VOA's International Edition continues. With all the other news or issues in the news in the United States, one story that's kind of slipped through the radar to some degree is one that environmentalists say could have major implications. The Trump administration is said to be spending $4 million on construction projects in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge in Alaska, in preparation for oil drilling in the nation's biggest wildlife park. The U.S. Department of the Interior says it's approved spending on projects for oil exploration readiness in the coastal plain of the Arctic Refuge. Joining us now to talk more about it is Nora Aptor, legislative advocate on the government affairs team at the Natural Resources Defense Council. Is this just a proposal or something more?
It is absolutely more than that. In December of last year, Congress passed its tax bill. And with everything and all of the controversy surrounding that bill, a a lot of people probably miss that included in the package was a provision that not only allowed but required oil and gas development in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. So the administration is now quickly acting and rushing forward with plans for oil and gas development in the Arctic Refuge in response to that congressional mandate.
This is a done deal? This was sort of thrown into a tax cut bill?
This is by no means a done deal, but it is absolutely a real possibility. This is the first time in history that the Arctic Refuge has been on the table for drilling. There are two parallel processes underway in the administration. The first is the environmental review process for the oil and gas lease sales themselves, which the administration is rushing to complete in just 1 year. So for comparison, a typical environmental review takes 2 to 3 years, roughly, to complete. So trying to rush this process, as you might imagine, in just 1 year is really dangerous and inevitably will compromise science and the public's ability to weigh in. So at the same time, there's a parallel process where the administration is reviewing permit applications for seismic testing. That's the process that oil and gas companies use to search for fossil fuels. Seismic testing alone is incredibly destructive.
Incredibly destructive in what way?
Seismic, as I said, is the process by which the companies search for oil and gas. It would be incredibly harmful. It leaves damaging grid marks across the tundra. For instance, there's scars from seismic exploration that was completed in the refuge in the 1980s that are still visible today. So more than 30 years later, we can still see on the landscape the impact from seismic exploration. It creates depressions on the ground that can impact water flows, even accelerate the thawing of permafrost in some areas. The seismic exploration would take place in critical habitat for polar bears right in the middle of their denning season. So really loud activity that could scare mother bears from their dens, potentially leaving their cubs to fend for themselves. And that's just the beginning. Seismic is the first step to drilling. So we're not even to the actual oil and gas development part.
And you mentioned the search for, as you put it, fossil fuels. We know fossil fuels are what has contributed to climate change. We know that from all the studies we've been seeing coming out lately, things are moving pretty rapidly. I would imagine that environmentalists don't think more oil and gas is the direction we should be taking.
You do have that right, absolutely. The administration, of course, is arguing that we need this gas, that the Arctic Refuge is central to Trump's quest for quote-unquote energy dominance. But this is really driven more by politics than economics. And even when it comes to the amount of oil projected to be in the Arctic Refuge's coastal plain, that wouldn't even significantly increase U.S. energy security. We don't need this oil. We are in an oil glut. There is little to no change in the price of gas predicted if the Arctic Refuge were to be developed. And even if we did need this, you know, if the Arctic Refuge is the last place we should be tearing to get to it. The Arctic National Wildlife Refuge is one of America's last truly wild places. And oil and gas development in the refuge would be devastating. It would hurt the landscape, the wildlife, and our climate. We're talking about 19 million acres of pristine wild lands and wildlife unlike anything still found in the lower 48. The refuge is home to polar bears, wolves, migratory birds from all 6 continents and all 50 states. Also, the most important onshore denning habitat for polar bears in the U.S. The Arctic is ground zero for climate change. We know that the temperatures there are rising twice as fast as the rest of the world. So drilling an Arctic refuge would make climate pollution even worse, not to mention hurt communities that are already seeing the impacts of climate change firsthand every day.
Is there any legal recourse that environmental organizations like yourselves can do to stop this from happening?
NRDC will use every tool in the toolbox to fight this.
Does the public get a say in this?
Absolutely. The public has already had one opportunity to weigh in, and that was at the first step in the administrative process for oil and gas leasing. As part of that, there were more than 700,000 public comments submitted in opposition to the administration's proposal. There will be another opportunity for the public to weigh in mid-October. So that's another chance for the public to raise their voices and their concern about selling off these pristine public lands to corporate polluters. The administration is really rushing to make this happen before the end of the Trump administration's first term. They want to get these public lands out of public hands so that the next administration can't come in and undo the process.
That's Nora Apter, legislative advocate on the government affairs team at the Natural Resources Defense Council. Well, there was a musical tribute to the ailing Queen of Soul last night, and AP Entertainment editor Oscar Wells Gabriel reports it came from a person many consider the hottest performer out there today.
What you are? You might think it was fate that brought Beyoncé to Aretha Franklin's own backyard, Detroit, last night, but there she was at Ford Field performing with her husband Jay-Z as part of their summer tour. The expressions of support for Franklin began well before the headliners took the stage. DJ Khaled hyped the crowd by playing one of Aretha's biggest hits, Respect. The Detroit Free Press reports that during the show, Beyoncé dedicated her performance to Franklin and expressed thanks to her for the beautiful music she has done during her career. The show came the same day a source close to Franklin told the Associated Press that the singer is seriously ill. I'm Oscar Wells Gabriel.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thanks so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Greg Burns. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In a recent speech in Washington addressing the previous or current violations of either the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty or the Chemical Weapons Convention by the regimes of Syria and Iran, Assistant Secretary of State for the Bureau of Arms Control, Verification, and Compliance, Yalem Poblete, said all responsible nations are challenged. Dr. Poblete noted that the U.S. national security strategy under President Donald Trump calls for the augmentation of measures to prevent the spread of and to eliminate weapons of mass destruction and related materials, their delivery systems and technologies. It further underscores the need to hold state and non-state actors accountable for the use of WMD. Regarding chemical weapons, Assistant Secretary Poblete pointed out that the Assad regime has brazenly violated the international norm prohibiting their use. The Joint Investigative Mechanism of the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons and the UN clearly established that the Syrian regime was responsible for 4 cases of chemical weapons use against the Syrian people. Syria also remained in continued noncompliance with the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty and its safeguards agreement with the International Atomic Energy Agency. Assad started to construct an undeclared plutonium production reactor in the Da'er al-Zour region, which was destroyed by Israel in an airstrike in 2007. Syria has persistently refused to cooperate with investigators from the IAEA about the reactor or address outstanding questions about its activities at the site and other related sites. With regard to Iran and its nuclear ambitions, the Iran nuclear deal from which the United States withdrew in May was severely flawed. Assistant Secretary Poblete said that among its chief defects, the deal failed to prevent Iran from ever having fissile material production capabilities that would permit it to rapidly break out into weaponization. In addition, its verification provisions did not go far enough, and most concerning of all, it did not cover Iran's missile or chemical weapons programs. Assistant Secretary Poblete cited President Trump's assertion in the National Security Strategy that the scourge of the world today is a small group of rogue regimes that violate all principles of free and civilized states. The response to those states must be constant vigilance. Noncompliance and blatant disregard of international legal obligations must be thoroughly reviewed, documented, and assessed, Assistant Secretary Poblete emphasized. Then, appropriate action and accountability can and must follow.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.